Over the next 6 weeks, to commemorate the 80th anniversary of D-Day, we'll be releasing three special episodes to tell the full story of The Longest Day. This first part is a complete remastering of our original Tide of Victory episode, with the addition of much new content.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this special episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. D-Day 80, Part 1, Tide of Victory. This first episode takes us to the south coast of Britain, which, in May 1944, resembled one huge army camp as over 2 million men waited for D-Day. In the Buckinghamshire countryside, the staff at GC&CS carried on feeding detailed and crucial intelligence to the Allied forces that would play an integral part in the success of the upcoming Operation Overlord. The Western Front Committee was established at Bletchley Park in 1942, and for the next 18 months built up a comprehensive picture of German forces in the West, recording every unit, its location, and its strength. From February 1943, the committee began to produce reports, of which over 450 pages are now held in our archives. Head of content, Erica Munro, and our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, used these to illustrate how the various departments, using multiple sources, came together to create the vital information that D-Day planners needed, in some cases even leading to last-minute changes. Meanwhile, our research officer, Dr. Thomas Cheatham, brings us the full story of a temporary Y station set up at Bletchley Park just for D-Day. Many thanks to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
England has become one vast ordnance dump and field park. In every wood and copse, in leafy dead-end lanes and side roads, often in private gardens, under quarries and embankments, there it all was. Trucks, ambulances, tanks, armoured cars, carriers, jeeps, bulldozers, ducks, vehicles of all kinds. Vast, really vast numbers of them. Right in the midst of it all, just as I'd turn for home, I passed a field where 22 men in khaki shirts and battle-dress trousers and heavy hobnail boots were having a quiet knock-up game of cricket. They made me think of Francis Drake and Plymouth Hoe.
I imagine you must have seen quite a build-up of troops in the run-up to D-Day.
Oh, there was.
Here on the south coast.
And D-Day itself, I mean, we knew, because we were actually living right as far south as you can possibly get in Lancing. The other side of our garden was the beach.
Uh-huh.
So that's how far we were. I mean, had they come over, the Germans, we would have been the first they'd have seen. And on D-Day itself, we were woken very early in the morning with planes droning over. And, of course, we could hear the gunfire from the other side.
Could you?
Oh, yes.
David, it's often suggested that staff at Bletchley Park were quite isolated from the war and that D-Day came as a complete surprise to them. How true is this?
It is true for some of the staff. It crops up in a number of our oral history accounts where veterans describe how the first thing they knew about D-Day was when they heard it on the BBC or they read about it in the paper. But that tends only to apply to the junior staff. By 1944, as we've discussed before, Bletchley Park was highly compartmentalised, and most of the more junior staff had very little idea of what their own job was, let alone its wider significance. So it's true that many of the kind of the worker bees would have been completely in the dark.
Remind us, how many of these worker bees were there at this point?
There's about 7,000 people in the organisation by the summer of 1944. So it's a lot of people. But there are some of those people who absolutely need to know that the invasion is planned and that the invasion planners need them to know so that they can provide suitable intelligence. One of the things that people forget about Bletchley is that it never has enough resources to do everything. There's far more German radio traffic out there, or Italian or Japanese, whatever. There's far more traffic out there than they can ever intercept on any one day. So they have to be quite choosy about which frequencies they listen to, which networks they try and target. Even after that, with Enigma, which keys they try and break, because they only have a certain number of bomb machines. So their resources are always having to be targeted to answer the key questions that the military and the intelligence people actually need answered. It's no point in generating loads of information about what's happening in Italy if you want to invade Normandy. So the key people at Bletchley have to understand what the various armed services and the planners are planning so that they can tell them the right information. So they have to really be keyed in from the beginning.
Different teams were providing different information to the planners so that preparations for D-Day could take place. When did this all start?
The intelligence has been produced since the beginning of the war in many ways, but in terms of identifying a point when they are specifically thinking about an invasion of Northwest Europe, a good day to start with is the 10th of October 1942. It's about 18 months before the invasion actually happens. Because on that day is the first meeting of an organisation called the Western Front Committee. And this was set up in Air Section by Professor Bowes. And initially there's only four people in this committee, but he called a meeting to say, what do we know about the Germans in France? Do we have an order of battle for them? An order of battle is a list of where all their troops are, how many tanks they've got, all the information you need about their fighting forces. So Bowes says, do we have an order of battle for the Germans? Are we compiling one? What's happening? And the response he gets is, we're not doing it in a very organised way. There's bits and pieces of information there, but it's not being systematically collated. So he and the committee decide that from that point forward, they will make it their mission to gather together every piece of information that comes into Bletchley Park that might be relevant to an invasion and sort of compile it together and produce this order of battle and to detail maps of where the Germans are and everything. At this point, they don't know when the invasion is going to be. They don't know exactly where the invasion is going to be. All they know is that at some time in the future, the Allies are likely to land somewhere in the northwest of Europe. So they're kind of working in the dark, but at the same time, they know the kind of information they're likely to need. And they actually take over a room in Block B, just next door to us here, room 149 in Block B. And the idea in there is they will have maps that are updated whenever information comes in. They have specific filing cabinets, so all of the data can be collated. And they actually recruit a lady called Diana Pears, who we otherwise know as the secretary of the Scottish Dancing Club. And her job was to be in there as a sort of manager of the whole thing and keep all these papers together. And what's really useful for a historian is that from October 1942 right up to D-Day, they kept detailed minutes of their weekly and then fortnightly meetings.
So it wasn't just that they started on the 10th of October with this vague plan. The plan was to meet regularly.
Every Saturday morning, they would get together. And the idea was, although there's only four of them initially, the committee grows to about 20 people as other branches of Bletchley Park get involved. And the idea is that every week, people bring to the table what they've learnt that week about the Germans. And everybody gets a chance to compare it with what they know. And then it's absorbed into the system in room 149 and added to the maps and added to the documentation so that they're piecing that jigsaw puzzle together in that one room. And what's really good from my point of view is that each piece of intelligence that they find, they record in the minutes. So you can actually watch the picture being coloured in item by item, week by week, as they get together and say, oh, we found out about this division here, or we found out about that unit over there.
Record of Western Front number 1, for period up to 15th of February 1943. Produced by Western Front Committee. Explanatory introduction. The primary aim of these reports is to aid members of the committee in the correlation of Western Front intelligence produced at BP. For the purpose of the reports, the Western Front is held to include the whole of France and to extend to northern Norway. The reports will be produced after the committee meetings, which take place twice monthly. They will be based mainly on notes submitted in advance by the committee members. These notes will be assembled and edited in room 149, Block B, and then debated at the subsequent committee meeting. In their agreed form, they will be given a limited internal distribution with MSS security.
What you have to remember, of course, is this isn't a static picture. The Germans are moving units into France, they're moving units out of France. And so this isn't a one-time exercise. You have to keep refreshing the order of battle as the Germans do different things. And particularly in 1942 and 1943, the Germans don't consider France to be under immediate threat. They're building the Atlantic Wall, but they don't think the invasion is going to happen, you know, next week or even next month. So France serves in many ways as a sort of rest and recuperation area for the German army. They don't have any reserves in Germany. They're too stretched to have anybody who is purely kind of in training. But what they tend to do is they move troops from the active fronts in the east in Russia or in Italy. And those units, when they need rest or retraining or whatever, they come to France and they form the garrison of France, but they're kind of having a rest at the same time. And what that means is when units arrive in France from Russia, for example, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to stay there and become part of the permanent garrison of France, because it might be that after 6 weeks, they've finished re-equipping with new tanks or they've finished training or whatever, and then they disappear again. So it's a matter of constantly monitoring this fluctuating picture. That has an extra dimension to it, because it's not just about the military task. It's not just about who are the soldiers going to have to fight on the beach. There's a political dimension to it. Churchill and Roosevelt meet at Casablanca in January 1943. And that conference is probably when the real foundations of D-Day are laid. Again, it's 18 months before the invasion. But at that point, there is a difference of opinion between the US and the UK. The Americans can't see the point of fighting anywhere other than in Northwest Europe. Their attitude is get the troops on the beach as near to Berlin as possible, push on through, win the war. Churchill has a much more indirect view of things, and he's very keen to continue the campaign in Italy and develop the war down there. And he's also concerned that the German defences in France are just too strong, and that if they launch the attack in France prematurely and they haven't built up enough of the Allied forces and they haven't got everything together properly, that the invasion will fail. So there's a tension between the two governments. And the question that Churchill needs answered is how many Germans are there? You know, if we attack on any particular month, what would the Allied forces be facing? Is it viable? Are we likely to win? And the work Bletchley's doing on the German order of battle, as well as all the other intelligence organisations, is really key to that political debate. Because if they come back and say there are too many Germans on the beach, then there's no point in launching the invasion because it's going to fail.
Across the channel, along the coast in the hands of the Nazis, there is feverish activity. Materials, equipment and men are being poured into the outer ring of Europe's defenses, especially men, for the enslaved labor of Europe is cheap. This is Hitler's newsreel. It is being shown throughout Europe to convince the subject peoples that their hopes of delivery are vain, to convince the German people that their fears of invasion are groundless. But Hitler can't believe his own propaganda. The Nazis know the invasion is coming. Why else are they so desperately arming the fortress? Why this gigantic mushrooming of platforms, mountings, rangefinders, the biggest rifles, the most powerful weapons, gathered from all the arsenals of Europe, the factories of Krupp, the foundries of Skoda in Czechoslovakia, of Schneider-Crusoe in France, all converging on the old towns of the French seacoasts. Under canopies of camouflage, the batteries look out to sea. Besides the protected emplacements are the artillery strong points, all types and calibers of guns, then the trenches, the barbed wire, the pillboxes. A myriad system of defenses, organized in depth, spiderwebbed along the headlands and the beaches, the valleys, and the hills behind.
So would Bletchley have been in a position to provide that information at any of these points prior to actually June 1944? Were they to say, where is the order of battle standing right now? And would Bletchley have been able to give that response?
Yes, that is one of the things they're doing. And interestingly, Anthony Eden, who's foreign secretary at the time, goes to Russia and he's having a conversation with some of Stalin's people because they're very keen, as we've talked about in this podcast before, they're very keen for the second front to happen. They're like, why haven't you got on with it? And Eden is discussing the German strength in France. And he says to Voroshilov, I think, we have means of knowing very securely how many Germans there are in France. Which is a bit of a gaffe on his part, because he shouldn't really be giving that sort of information away. But he is right that they have pretty good confidence in their facts and figures. And that comes ultimately from what Bletchley and the other organisations are doing.
If the Western Front Committee was meeting weekly to collate this information, to summarise it, how is that then being fed in a useful manner to those that needed to know it?
Well, they are producing a variety of sort of synthetic documents. They're not reporting the intelligence directly to the various planning departments in the way that we tend to think about Bletchley as, you know, they get a signal in, they redraft it, it goes off as ultra to a commander. It's a more long-term process than that, and they're developing longer documents that are a synthesis of a whole series of messages rather than individual intelligence items. So they produce a full written order of battle, for example. They produce these documents where every German formation is listed, that they know about where they think it is, who they think the commander is. And although all of those don't survive in the National Archives, several of them do. And the last one that comes out in May of 1944 is number 12. So the inference from that is that there were 11 previous ones, and that works out about every month or 6 weeks that they're producing a kind of state of what we know document at that point. They're also producing independent reports on other aspects of the question. So there might be documents on the German railways, or there might be documents on particular aspects of air defence. You know, a multitude of subjects are covered, and they're all born out of this ability to pull all the intelligence together in one place. One of the other things that happens at Casablanca is there's the decision to appoint a supreme commander. It will be a joint operation, and somebody needs to be in charge of it. The initial assumption is that the supreme commander will be British, because the greater part of the invasion force will be British and Commonwealth. In the end, Eisenhower is selected, who's an American. But the decision was, if the supreme commander was going to be an American, then his deputy would be British. And so the chief of staff to the supreme Allied commander is a man called Frederick Morgan, General Frederick Morgan. He's appointed in early 1943 to start the formal planning process. And he sets up an organization that takes the acronym COSAC, without a K, which is Chief of Staff to the Supreme Allied Commander. And although Eisenhower doesn't take up his post until the end of 1943, beginning of 1944, the planning body is put together under Morgan's direction. And straight away, they start talking regularly to Bletchley Park. Oscar Oeser, who's one of the people who is a member of the Western Front Committee, but was also the head of liaison for Hut 3, he talks about going to London, you know, on a weekly basis to go to the War Office, to go to COSAC, to these other organisations, and discuss what their thinking was, what information they needed. Also, what's interesting, because it goes against some of the things that have been said about Bletchley in the past, is that it's definitely a sort of feedback loop. Oeser is going to London and saying, what do you guys need to know? And they will ask him specific questions and go, can you find out more about X or Y? And then he brings that back and they go, right, we now need to focus our attention on trying to understand this particular thing. And so that sort of two-way process is very important. And the history of Hut 3 actually talks about the fact that the liaison officers would go even if they had nothing planned to discuss, just because they thought that maintaining the human relationships was important. The history of Hut 3 actually uses the word, it was good for the planners to realise that this intelligence was brought to them by humans, mm-hmm. which I think is a great phrase. It captures one of the problems with intelligence, which is a lot of it can be quite vague, and there's a problem with credibility. If your customers don't believe you, or they don't take you sufficiently seriously, then the intelligence becomes useless. So the fact that these people are meeting weekly, that they're getting to know each other as individuals, and they're beginning to trust each other, means that when Bletchley says, you know, there are some Germans over there, that information is taken seriously by the planners and the plan can be correctly assembled as a consequence.
COSAC was the chief of staff of the Supreme Allied Commander. When did the Supreme Allied Commander become the larger part of the picture rather than Bletchley Park reporting to the chief of staff?
Eisenhower takes post in January 1944. And what was COSAC now becomes SHAEF, the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force. That is a large planning organisation. They're initially in central London, then they move to Bushey Park, which is down near Hampton Court. Again, it's a very large organisation. The planning they're doing for Overlord is extraordinarily complicated. So it's not just one office, it's several thousand people, you know, developing all the different aspects of the plan. And at that point, the headquarters starts to receive ULTRA, as we familiarly know it, as well as these background briefings from Hut 3. They're also getting daily ULTRA messages so that they can see what the Germans are doing, kind of in real time, as well as the sort of more background briefings. Partly this is so that when the invasion actually happens, there are these SLUs, as they're called, there are these units that accompany the invading force commanders on the battlefield to give them their ultra intelligence there and then. And these have already been functioning in Italy. The SLUs are actually set up in the spring of 1944, and they start operating and communicating with the various bits of SHAEFE, with 21st Army Group and with the various American armies. The idea being, again, that if you can get the working relationship going and you can get the systems functioning, then you don't do it for the first time on D-Day. That would be quite a bad plan.
I suppose then you can deploy them immediately after the invasion has succeeded.
Yes. The idea is that they function in the UK in the lead up to the invasion, and once the invasion happens, they then follow the troops into France and they carry on working.
The United States recently opened its own radio station in Britain to tell the people of Europe the true news of the world and what to expect in the near future. For a description of this station, Admiral takes you to London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
The American broadcasting station in Europe has its premises, appropriately enough, in a section of London that is inhabited by the peoples of many European countries. One corner of a building in this polyglot and somewhat exotic atmosphere has been taken over by ABSI, as everyone calls the American broadcasting station in Europe. There's not much room, and the 90-odd people who operate ABSI are practically in each other's laps. Most of those people, even those who broadcast in European languages, are Americans and have been sent over here from America. ABSI exists here in London because it has been thought important to present a peculiarly American point of view to the people of Europe. Happily, the framework of the United Nations is not so restrictive that it precludes different emphasis by different nations on different things. ABSI exists to give the American emphasis. ABSI is on the air right now. Its call sign is recognized everywhere as unmistakably American. It goes like this. To Europe, that means America is on the air. And that phrase from Yankee Doodle is as American as Uncle Sam's striped pants and star-spangled waistcoat. The BBC and ABSI are doing complementary jobs. They're talking to the same people in different ways, and they are both doing their jobs well. It has been a hard job to get an American broadcasting station in Europe into operation, but it has been done because a lot of people have been willing to work hard, to work intently and earnestly for something they believed in. These people believed that the voice of America must be heard.
You said that in the Western Front Committee reports, this picture of intelligence is created. Where did this intelligence come from? What sources were available?
Well, one of the great things about the information in the Western Front Committee reports is that you're getting these individual items of intelligence, but also from March 1944, they add an extra page to their weekly report. And in that, they list very specifically what source has provided each nugget of intelligence. And you can plot out what's coming from Enigma, what's coming from Lorentz traffic from Fish, what's coming from traffic analysis, what's coming from human sources in France. And you can really map in detail where all these different things are coming from. And that makes quite interesting reading, because we're familiar with Bletchley as the home of Enigma breaking, but actually in 1943 and 44, Enigma is only a relatively small part of the picture, certainly as far as the German army is concerned. The Luftwaffe are quite profligate with Enigma. They send lots of wireless messages. Their wireless procedures are quite poor, so their Enigma is broken all the time. And RED in particular, which is one of the widespread Luftwaffe networks, is broken every day. So that's kind of the bread and butter. The German army, by contrast, use a lot of landline communications because they're in France. They've been there for several years. They're not moving around very much. And so they can communicate by landline telephone and landline teleprinter. So they're not really sending very much Enigma traffic at all. And so Army Enigma isn't very informative during this period. The teleprinter traffic, the Fish traffic, by contrast, produces all sorts of information, because they not only use that for high command discussions, because Lorentz messages are much longer, they're sort of 4,000 characters versus 200 characters. They're great for sending boring administrative reports. And so Bletchley is able to break a whole series of these administrative returns, which are very long, and they're often written in an abbreviated fashion that makes them quite difficult to understand. But once you can really get into them, they include information. In some cases, you get strengths of panzer divisions, not just in personnel and tanks, but in the number of pistols they've got, the number of bicycles they've got, the number of lorries they've got. Every last bit of equipment is listed.
Spreadsheet almost.
It's like a spreadsheet. And the problem with it is it tends to say column one, you know, 25, 15, 2000, 44. And unless you know what column one represents, it's a bit difficult. But there was a specialist team in Hut 3, the Proformers team, and their whole job was working out what the columns on these spreadsheets actually meant. But once you can do that, then it gives you an extraordinarily detailed picture of the units that are being discussed. So the teleprinter stuff is really, really important. What Army Enigma does, which is nonetheless useful, is the Germans have anti-invasion exercises. And what that means is that particular radio networks will spark to life and they'll send lots of communications, training for when an invasion might happen. And the traffic they're actually sending, because it's all, let's pretend, isn't very important. But it allows Bletchley and the traffic analysis people at Bletchley particularly to map the network. And so it tells you a huge amount about their organisational structure and their order of battle, even though the message content itself isn't very important. So the fact that the Germans run a number of anti-invasion exercises gives Bletchley a huge amount of useful information.
Western Front Committee, Sources and Contributors. Section 1, Abwehr, Dr. Palmer. All from ISOS and ISK sources. Section 2, Navy, Lieutenant Talbot Ponsonby from Dolphin, Place and Shark, Captain Edwards, Traffic Analysis. Section 3A, Army, Captain Price Jones from Jellyfish, Solo, Quince and Bream, Captain Edwards, Traffic Analysis. Section 3B, Army, Major Brown from German Army Medium Grade Ciphers and Traffic Analysis. Section 4, German Police, Major Evans from Solo and Poker.
The final thread in terms of signals intelligence specifically is the Japanese. Japanese diplomats in Europe are meeting the Germans regularly and they're reporting back to Tokyo regularly on what they've learnt. So Ambassador Oshima in Berlin is a very important source. The naval and military attachés that are not only in Berlin, there's also with the Vichy government in France and various other places, they all produce information about the Germans.
That intelligence coming from the Japanese sources, was that being intercepted and gathered directly by the British Armed Forces or was that coming from the Americans?
It's a mixture. The purple traffic in particular, which is the famous stuff from Ambassador Oshima, is broken mostly in the United States and shared with us. But a number of the other codes, Japanese military attaché traffic, for example, that's broken by John Tiltman here at Bletchley in 1942. And so some of the ciphers work is being done here and some of it's been done in the States. But the key to success, as we've said many times with this operation, is that what's being done in the US and what's being done in the UK is being shared across the Atlantic and everybody's on the same page with what they're doing.
Are there other agencies that are contributing information?
Yes, this is another thing which I think is really important and hasn't been brought out quite as much in previous accounts of Bletchley. And this is the fact that Bletchley is one intelligence agency among several and you have a variety of other activities going on. You have air photography down at Medmenham. You have prisoner of war interrogation, famously with the generals being bugged at Trent Park. And you have a lot of human intelligence, so agents on the ground run both by the Secret Intelligence Service and by SOE. And all of those bodies are producing information about the Germans in France. And again, Bletchley has a very close liaison with those organisations and they're sharing signals intelligence with these other agencies and they're sharing information back. There is an example where agents in southern Belgium report that a particular town is suddenly full of young SS men. And Bletchley is able to compare that with signals intelligence, which they think is coming from one of the SS Panzer divisions. And so those two pieces of information fit together really nicely. And the next step in that process was you could then send air reconnaissance to photograph that particular location, knowing that you think there's troops there, and then you can count the tanks or whatever it is. So again, the liaison between the different agencies and them all supporting one another is really important. And it's something that in the past, books have suggested that, like people not knowing about D-Day, that somehow Bletchley was this academic ivory tower where people just only ever looked at Enigma messages and didn't cloud their minds with anything else. A lot of people are doing that, as we've discussed, but there's also this intense liaison and cooperation going on with all these other agencies. And that's what makes the intelligence behind Normandy really successful.
There's all these different strands. Where is all this being collated? Where is all this being analysed?
Certainly for the land campaign, the Army and to a certain extent the Air Force, Hut 3 is really important in this process. Hut 3 sets out initially as the kind of Enigma intelligence interpretation unit for Army and Air Force. By 1944, they're not just doing Enigma, they're getting feeds from Fish and from a variety of other sources. And their job is to pull all this stuff together and turn it into useful multi-source intelligence. And they are also getting these reports from the other agencies as well. And so Hut 3 is really at the middle of it. The head of Hut 3 is Eric Jones. I've described him as the spider at the center of the web because he is running this organization who compile all this data and run the famous indexes where all these pieces of information are being written on 6x4 index cards and filed away so that the jigsaw puzzle pieces can be assembled when required. Hut 3 is quite a large operation by this point. It's about 500 people. So there's lots of different bits of it, but they combine together to produce this steady flow of really, really useful information.
Top secret. Hut 3, headlines 9709, Broadway building for Section 2 only. Admiralty for DNI personal. CX-MSS-T172-24. At 1300 hours, 4th of April, 1944. Itinerary for tour of inspection, 22nd of April to 13th of May, by Inspector General of Panzer Troops, showing locations of German panzer units in France.
The tremendous concentration of army and other people in the Dover area, when they were having the Fortitude operation and giving the Germans the impression we were going to invade Cap Grenet. Then shortly before D-Day, I think the social life rather came to a stop. We weren't allowed to go beyond 20 miles from our base from the end of March 1944. Well, I saw Churchill and Monty, which was the only time in the war, and I came out of the direction-finding tower 8 in the morning, saw a whole lot of what looked like staff officers, and then rather distinctive black beret and hat in the middle. I thought, my goodness, and I could not think what they were coming over our cliff for. Nobody did. And I thought, well, I'm supposed to salute senior officers, but only if you're wearing a hat. And coming out at 8 in the morning in an old jersey and duff coat, one wouldn't be wearing a hat. So I waved at them all and said, hello, good morning. And they all waved back and said, good morning. And I think it was part of Fortitude and that they wanted to be seen around Dover, looking across. And I only thought of that long afterwards, but looking across at Cap Grenet.
One of the misconceptions, you know, like to bust a myth, of course.
You do.
And one of the myths about Bletchley Park is that all the traffic is intercepted here. And we've said in the past that actually radio traffic is intercepted elsewhere and it's brought to Bletchley Park. There's this network of Y stations around the UK and overseas, which do this interception. There's a few good reasons for that. Firstly, setting up aerials at your top secret code-breaking station could be considered unwise. Bletchley Park isn't necessarily the place with the best reception. It's got the space to do the code-breaking work, but it's not necessarily got the best interception. It's not on top of a hill. Certain types of traffic, you have to have line of sight on your target. So you have stations, you know, round the coast on cliff tops where they get the best reception. And obviously, if you're intercepting traffic in theatre, that needs to be done overseas. And the other thing is, I've counted about 300 of these Y stations in the UK and a couple of hundred overseas. Mm. So you can't concentrate all that interception capacity in one place, even if you wanted to. So that goes on elsewhere, with one exception, which is around D-Day. There's a small unit set up at Bletchley Park to intercept traffic just during the invasion period.
And this is a section that we mentioned really briefly in the Overlord episode from 5 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Now, something that always niggled me with that Overlord episode is that we didn't really go into detail about this section. And this is the point where we can put that right now.
So the scene is what is in 1944, Hut 18, but it's the former Hut 8, which is famous, of course, as Alan Turing's section breaking naval enigma. By this point in the war, Hut 8, the section, have moved over to Block D. Hut 8 is empty and it gets renumbered Hut 18 and it gets taken over by part of Naval Section, so it's still part of the naval operation. It's used by Naval Section 5. Naval Section 5 does traffic analysis, all sorts of traffic, but obviously around D-Day, they're focusing on Germany and part of their task is because they understand the enemy networks is to direct interception as well, so they take on that secondary role. And in 1944, it's headed by Lieutenant E.R. Dogmore. And this whole plan for setting up a Y station at BP is Doug Moore's idea. He's a man we don't know very much about his professional background, I can't tell you. We don't have any photos of him. We don't even actually know what ER, his first initials, stand for.
Right, okay.
But his name is all over this in the records. Doug Moore's thinking about how the Naval Y Service can best serve the invasion on the day and especially protect the invasion fleet, because that's the moment the invasion can fail, is if the invasion fleet comes under attack. That's when everybody is at the most vulnerable, as we've seen in the German E-boat attack on Operation Tiger at Slapton Sands, where they sink a couple of troop transports and cause great loss of life. Ships at sea with troops aboard are incredibly vulnerable, even if you have the best protection. And Doug Moore knows the Naval Wire Service, it's quite large, hundreds of receivers in Scarborough, Flower Down, along the coastline. They're good at what they do, but they're not particularly targeted in the sense that when BP needs to hear a certain line of traffic, it takes time for that to work its way through the system. So it takes time for the Y stations to be tasked, and it takes time for messages they intercept to make their way to BP. He wants to streamline the whole system and give Naval Section its own Y unit that it can direct in a very tailored way, almost minute by minute, to get the traffic they need to be intercepting on the day. Because, you know, that delay of an hour or two in getting messages from the Y stations, normally that's not a problem, but on the day, minutes might be the difference between victory and disaster.
And we know that on the day, sometimes decrypts were being sent out to the field in 2.5 hours, don't we?
Yeah, the turnaround they achieve is very quick. And it's hard for us to work out which of those intercepts are coming from BP and literally being run across site here, and which are arriving from the Y stations.
Time is of the essence.
Absolutely, time is of the essence. And also having this station at BP, in a way, it also takes pressure off the other Y stations. They can get on with sort of doing the large-scale interception and doing that as efficiently as possible. So when you've got specific intercept tasks, you're taking it out of their hands.
Yeah.
And it just makes their job more efficient as well. It's not about replacing the Y stations. It's about making them more efficient as well. So Doug Moore has this idea in early April, it looks like. Goes to his bosses. He had brought in a little radio receiver of his own, a little handheld antenna, and walked around BP to test the reception and make sure he could pick up some of those German networks which he was familiar with. And then he goes to his bosses, points out that they've actually got a room in Hut 18 which is perfect for this purpose. It's the big room in Hut 8. This is what used to be the main room for all the cryptanalysis. So it's a room where you can have maybe a dozen people working alongside each other, bouncing ideas off each other and discussing the work as they go along. And it's still there in 1944, and it's a perfect space to turn into a set room. You've got space to fit about 8 radio receivers, all the equipment and all the kind of office clutter you need to log the messages and process them. So he points out that they're using this room for training, but it can very easily be repurposed. It will be in the same building as his team directing the interception. So that's ideal, and it will be easy to put up some 30-foot telescoping masts outside the hut without causing too much disruption and also without making BP too big a target in the very unlikely event that the enemy do actually manage to get a plane over Buckinghamshire in 1944. It's not something they've got to worry about too much, but it's always something to keep in mind. And Frank Birch in charge of the Naval Section and the various other people running things go, great idea. And they put this whole plan into train.
That's quite a short period of time then beforehand.
Yeah. They don't wait around. There's quite a lot to arrange. Who are going to be these operators? Who you're going to bring in? BP were quite happy to have Wrens, but in the end they get naval ratings from Scarborough. It seems that was just simply because it was easier to sort out the logistics as far as housing and feeding them. And in the end they put them in the army camp. And it's easier to do that with male personnel than females. But as usual for Bletchley Park, the administration is quite improvised. So a lot of this has to be sorted out at the last minute and in quite an ad hoc way. Again, we've got good records of this whole process, and we can see in the records. One requirement of the operators is a tea urn, milk and sugar, because they expect to be able to make hot drinks while they're on watch, which seems really civilised to me.
Yes.
They're also entitled to their daily tot of naval rum, so that needs to be organised because the army camp obviously doesn't have any rum.
So they still get...
Of course they do, yeah. And they're also entitled to a cigarette ration. We have the figures in the memos. This amounts to 200 woodbines and 240 Kensitas per man per month. But it amounts to about 12 cigarettes per man per day. So, you know, something we can't recreate at BP is the environment of the smoke that would have existed in all of these buildings all of the time.
I think most rooms at BP at any point during World War II were probably just smoke-filled, I think, of one form or another.
Yeah, and various other odours, because one of the other problems they have is getting soap for these naval ratings. So apparently they go without soap for a couple of weeks.
Oh, dear.
While they're living in tents in the army camp. Well, we know the weather was bad before D-Day because the invasion is delayed and almost cancelled. And there is also a request for duck boards for the tents, because apparently they were getting quite wet and muddy and generally unkempt in their appearance. But to go back to the cigarettes, the way they get around this problem of providing the cigarette ration is that Lieutenant Doug Moore actually buys these cigarettes off his own back from the Navy, gives them to one of the Wren petty officers in his section and puts it in their hands to distribute them to the operators while they're on duty. So he gets his money back that way. So they have to put these systems in place to make sure these ratings are happy and working efficiently, of course. like everybody else at BP. They have to have the right security briefings, they have to get the correct passes, all this stuff has to be arranged. And as well as that, of course, the hut has to be outfitted, the aerials have to be erected, everything has to be connected, so there's quite a lot of wiring involved, and it would have been a very hectic couple of weeks while they're putting this operation in place. It comes online in the middle of May, so they're ready before D-Day. They're monitoring the traffic, obviously, ahead of the invasion, looking out for anything that will tip them off about what the enemy expect to happen. And they, of course, don't see any of the evidence of the Germans moving their destroyers into the correct position or anything along those lines. What they're mainly focusing on is they're trying to increase the speed at which Hut 8 can break the ciphers every day. Naval Enigma ciphers change at midday. It can take about 12 hours normally for those ciphers to be broken. Around the invasion, that will just be too slow. So what they're focusing on is the traffic that gives you those cribs which you need to break the ciphers, those predictable messages that you can use to program your bomb machines. And they're trying to get those to the cryptanalysts in Hut 8 just a few hours earlier than they normally would, so they can get on with breaking the ciphers. They have a number of frequencies they know contained those cribs that they needed. And they put a list of those together. They call it Cover A. And every day, Hut 18 focuses on Cover A until such time as the keys are broken, especially the key they call Dolphin at Bletchley Park. The Germans call it Heimisch. That's the home waters key. So it's the main key used in the English Channel and various other places. When they break that key, they can move on to covering operational traffic, which they call Cover B. When we look at our naval intercepts and our decrypts, we can't see very much traffic on the Cover A frequencies because presumably that was filtered out as uninteresting after the keys have been broken, but we see lots of those frequencies which are on the Cover B list because those are, you know, the networks being used in the channel to report what's going on, direct patrol boats, coordinate coastal gunfire on D-Day itself, all of the operational traffic which Naval Section needs to be reading.
I hadn't thought about the timing issue. So when the key settings change, it's 12 midday. So when you've discovered those key settings, that covers you in the most important period, doesn't it, for the dawn attacks?
It does. Obviously, the invasion fleet will be at sea for most of the night. And if it takes you 12 hours to break the key, that could leave you with your fleet at sea for 3 or 4 hours before you're able to read enemy traffic. But you're right, you know, Naval Section can be expecting to break Enigma quite a few hours before the troops go ashore and keep reading it right up to midday, which is when, you know, the chief period of danger is past. So that's potentially very beneficial as long as the enemy don't realise what's up in the early part of the night, and then you could have a problem. This is always the expectation. The Allies expect the Germans to know about the coming invasion by the evening of the 5th of June. And it's quite a surprise that it takes them so long to realise what's going on. But one of the things they'll notice from intercepting this traffic is that it takes the Germans much longer to realise that the invasion is taking place than the planners had assumed.
World News Today, brought to you by a shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations as well as leading news centres of our own country. CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Douglas Edwards.
Today in Italy, Allied troops of the Fifth Army have occupied Fondi and are battering their way forward toward the Anzio beachhead while the Eighth Army attacks the main defenses of the Hitler line in the Liri Valley. To the northwest, Allied air power is punching new holes in Germany's invasion defenses. Moscow says the opening of the Western invasion front is imminent and that the Germans know the Allies can break any defenses they set up. American bombers from Britain continue to attack the French coast. For details, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
American bombers have been out today, in spite of uncertain weather in the Straits of Dover, attacking targets in France and Germany. The RAF were over northwest Germany last night, taking care of their end of the Allied air offensive. This cooperation between the RAF and the American Air Force is much more than a matter of simply picking out targets for one or the other to destroy. It's much deeper and has gone on much longer than that. There are, for instance, a surprising number of Americans who are in the United States Army and wear American uniform who are serving with the RAF. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
So how does it actually go on the day for this brand new Y section in Hut 18?
Well, of course, they're working, you know, at full capacity, and there must have been, you know, a lot of tension because it's all been working up to this point. But it goes very well. They break Naval Enigma at about 7:40 in the evening on the 5th of June. They've broken the keys nice and early so that any traffic which they're picking up from the channel that might be forces about to interfere with the invasion fleet can be picked up and processed by Bletchley as fast as physically possible. And as we can see, that means in about 2.5 hours. So that reaction doesn't appear. And there isn't a moment where we can say, Hut 18 saves D-Day.
No.
Because that attack doesn't come. What they are able to do on D-Day is to note that a group of German destroyers based in Western France at Royan, which is at the mouth of the Garonne, they leave harbour and they begin sailing north towards the invasion zone on D-Day. And they're almost there on the 8th of June when they're attacked by a British force and defeated, and one of the destroyers is forced to beach itself and another is sunk, and the rest flee into harbour and basically are neutralised. And that's because Ultra has been tracking their progress all the way up the French coast. So the fact there is no big climactic battle on D-Day or after in the Channel is because they're doing such a good job of cramping the style of the German naval forces so effectively before D-Day and afterwards. And Ultra feeds into that as well. So you don't have to worry about a big naval battle in the Channel. What we can really say is that the contribution the station makes by enabling them to break the quays earlier on the evening of the 5th of June is that it gives Allied commanders that confidence that the Germans haven't anticipated the invasion is coming. Planners have assumed that the Germans will be aware about 12 hours before the troops hit the beach. And what we can see from the naval traffic is that it takes much longer. It's only a couple of hours. In some cases, while the landings are underway, before the German commanders are really aware of what's going on and that this is not just a raid and not just maybe a commando operation, but this is actually the invasion.
Can you give us some examples, I mean, specific examples of the kind of intelligence that was being used to feed into this bigger picture?
I can, and that's one of the great things about the Western Front Committee report is they highlight particular moments when particular really important information came in. And then from there, you can then track down in other archives the particular messages that were concerned. And one of the most spectacular, if you like, was in April 1944. And this was a teleprinter message on the Jellyfish network. Jellyfish was the link between Berlin and Paris and von Rundstedt, who's commander in the West. His tanks were being inspected by another German general, General Guderian, who was Inspector General of Panzer Troops. So his job was to look after, you know, the German army's tanks throughout Europe. And he went on a tour of all of the armoured formations, all the panzer divisions in France. And his itinerary was actually sent in a Jellyfish message.
Wow.
And you can read the message. There's a list here. I mean, he started off 28th of April. He went to the 2nd Panzer Division in Amiens. 29th of April, he went to the 12th SS Panzer Division in Evreux. And it goes on for 9 or 10 panzer divisions. And not only are we told that they're in France, but we're told specifically where their headquarters are in that message.
Goodness.
So in one message, you get more or less the complete order of battle of the German armoured formations in France.
You can sort of imagine somebody at Bletchley Park reading this message and popping a pin in on every line as they go through as to who's based where.
Yeah, once they've done 3 laps of the office, waving the peace flag above their head. It's the sort of intelligence gold that you don't see very often, but I can imagine the excitement when it came in must have been significant. Actually, one of the things that they do, not in consequence of this message, but one of the places on the list is Mailly-le-Camp. And Mailly-le-Camp was a tank training area near Paris, and that was subsequently bombed by the RAF. Not terribly successfully. The Germans had dispersed their tanks quite widely. They weren't parked in neat rows. They were sort of distributed all over the place. So not very much damage was done. Nonetheless, they were able to not just read this intelligence, but actually act on it as well. So that's a really good example of a really succinct message with a huge amount of intelligence value. I mean, there's not much piecing together you have to do with that message. It is just the finished list, really. And the other thing that happens, of course, is they attack Mailly-le-Camp as a consequence of this message. And then von Rundstedt sends a subsequent message in May, again via Jellyfish, where he reports the results of the bombing. He reports that 400 casualties have been inflicted, but there hasn't been much material damage. Not very many tanks have been destroyed.
So they can see the results of the interception.
Yeah, so they find out about these troops from a message, they attack them, and then the Germans tell them how badly they've damaged them.
Goodness.
So you get a sense of the level of understanding they have of what the Germans are up to.
And there's no chance that that report that there was minimal damage done to the tanks is some sort of deception. They must have been so confident, is proof that they were confident by sending the first message full of that useful information, that they were confident of the security of their network.
They are confident of the security of their networks, but when you use the word deception, you have to be a little bit careful, because what Rundstedt might say to Berlin isn't necessarily a completely true picture of the situation, because Rundstedt has his own agenda.
Right.
And this is one of the areas where Churchill wasn't as discerning as he might have been. In North Africa, you have the situation where he's reading ultra messages sent by Rommel back to Berlin. And Rommel complains that he's got no tanks and no petrol and all his men are sick and that he's about to lose the war, which isn't true. He does it because he wants to gain more resources and sympathy from the commanders in Berlin. Churchill tended to read those messages at face value. And you say to Auchinleck, why haven't you won the war yet? Because the Germans are clearly ripe for defeat. And Auchinleck's answer was, well, Rommel would say that, wouldn't he? You know, any good general does. Mm-hmm. When your high command asks, you don't say, oh, we've got enough stuff, thanks. Everything's fine. You know, here, take some men away. So you have to read von Rundstedt's assessments with the foreknowledge of why he's writing them and what things he might choose to emphasize in his reports. And because France isn't an active front, he's constantly fighting a campaign to retain what resources he's got. You know, as the battle deteriorates in the east and the Allied armies work their way up Italy, there is a lot of pressure on von Rundstedt to release troops from France to elsewhere. So he's never going to say he's got enough stuff. He's always going to underplay his strength. But as long as you know that and you read his reports within that context, but you're certainly right that I don't think he had any fear that those reports were being read by the Allies. I think he felt he could speak his mind between his colleagues.
And that's an incredible intercepted German message. Do you have any examples of Japanese intelligence and that contribution?
Yes, the Japanese, it's similarly detailed. One of the real ironies of the Normandy campaign is that both Ambassador Oshima and some of his attachés are taken to the defences in France, to the Atlantic Wall, by the Germans and given tours. And the idea is that Hitler's very proud of his achievements and he wants to show the Japanese how strong the German defences are and how fantastic they are. And so these diplomats are taken on tours. And they then draft messages back to Tokyo that are complete listings of the character of the defences. The Japanese naval attaché, Admiral Kojima, in particular, he goes to the Atlantic Wall in April 1944, and he sends a message back to Tokyo, which is pages and pages long, and it works its way down the coast, going, right, the defences of Calais are like this, the defences of Boulogne are like this. And then, you know, I can quote a bit, at Calais, one 40-centimetre battery of three guns, one 38-centimetre battery of three guns, and 128-centimetre battery of four guns. You know, that's real gun-by-gun detail of the German defences. And in some cases, it talks about individual machine guns. So it's really, really detailed. And again, this information isn't standalone information. The agents in France are doing a huge amount of work looking at the German Atlantic Wall defences. SOE and SIS have French agents who are making records of bunkers, they're counting machine guns, they're counting troops. And in some cases, these are the actual French contractors who are building the things, so they're quite intimately involved in the process, and they're able to steal plans and other information. But what that means is you can put that together with the Japanese diplomatic reports, and when they talk about bunkers, at the same time, the French resistance provided a plan of that particular model of bunker. And so by combining the different bits of information, the result is really, really detailed.
So by triangulating it, not only can you be more certain of the information that's coming through, you can actually see proof of the information from the Japanese source itself.
Yeah, triangulate is a good word. It's this cross-referring. And then, you know, you can send a low-level Spitfire and you can go and photograph it. And then when you get the photo back, you go, right, yeah, that's the gun that was being talked about in that report that's been spotted by that guy from the French resistance. And the result is an incredibly clear picture.
Western Front Committee, report dated 19th of May, 1944. German forces in the West. High grade and traffic analysis. Section 2, detail, armour. The total of tanks in the West is probably about 3,000, including 1,000 heavy tanks. It is suggested that the whole Panther production has been earmarked for the West, with an eye to building up a tank reserve to cope with Allied Shermans. 21st Panzer Division is moving north from Rennes to the area south of Caen. 1st SS Panzer Division Adolf Hitler is now located in the area of Antwerp, and elements of the 12th SS Division Hitlerjugend are at Nantes, although the main body of this latter division has been reported to have detrained in the area of L'Aigle and Dreux.
It's an incredibly clear picture. Was it a very clear picture in isolated areas, or was it a very clear picture across the board?
By the time you get to the summer of 1944, it's across the board. By that point, the number of German formations in France has fluctuated, as I was describing, but on the night of the 5th of June, there are 58 German divisions in France and Belgium. Bletchley Park knows about all of those divisions, at least at the headquarters level. It knows roughly their strengths, how many tanks they've got. It knows their command structures within the organisations. And so the picture of the Germans is more or less complete.
Is that something that was logged in the Western Front Committee report?
It was. And what's exciting about those reports is they've only been declassified since the early 2000s. And they've given us a much more in-depth picture of what Bletchley knew about the Germans. Ralph Bennett, who wrote a very good book called Ultra in the West back in 1978, when the Ultra traffic, so-called the messages sent to commanders, was first released to the National Archives, he read all of it. And there's something like 45,000 messages. So fair play to him. He went through the whole lot. And he'd actually worked in Hut 3 as a drafter of these messages originally. And what he did was he plotted the Ultra messages that he could see against the history of the campaign. And that's an extraordinarily useful exercise because his book is a kind of Bible. I don't have to read all 45,000 messages. I can look at Bennett and he will tell me which ones I need to look at. But where he went wrong was he assumed that if something wasn't in an Ultra message, then Bletchley didn't know it. And he looks at the German divisions in France and says, right, these ones appear in a message and these ones don't. And he inferred that some of the ones that didn't, that's because Bletchley didn't know very much about them. But what I've talked about a few minutes ago is this distinction between the long-term intelligence picture that Bletchley is delivering to its customers in other forms versus the daily Ultra intercepted message delivery. And there's many, many things that Bletchley knows that don't make it into those Ultra messages because they're not particularly urgent. No one needs to know them today. And a prime example of that is the two German divisions which are on the landing beaches, which is 716 Division and 709 Division. These are both static infantry formations that have been there for several years by the time you get to 1944. Everybody in the Allied intelligence knows that they're there, knows quite a lot about them. But they never do anything which is newsworthy. They just sit there. So they're never going to appear in an Ultra message because they haven't done anything very dramatic. You compare that with the Panzer formations. These are the units that are, in some cases, moving to Russia and coming back again. They're units that move around France as the Germans argue about how best to defend against invasion. So units that change their status regularly or change their location regularly will appear in Ultra traffic a lot. Ones that don't, won't. And what the Western Front Committee documentation has really shown us is that background picture. And that's really quite exciting to see.
Well, this is really exciting. So we now have a much better idea of the picture that Bletchley had in the war. It kind of reminds us, and we say this all the time as historians and interpreters of the Bletchley Park wartime story, that we don't know everything, but the picture is still in some cases quite cloudy. And it is exciting that these things, even now, decades later, are still being revealed.
Oh, very much so. Yes, it's what makes my job interesting. One of the issues is I'm asked, is this recently declassified information? And when I say yes, people think I mean last week or 2017. Actually, stuff in some cases might have gone to the National Archives 10 years ago, but there's so much of it that in those 10 years, no historian has chosen to look at it. So when we talk about new information and recently declassified information, we're talking historically rather than sort of journalistically, but it's very exciting nonetheless.
Generalfeldmarschall Rommel bei einer Lagebesprechung im Westen. Die deutsche Wehrmacht ist an dieser Küste auf einen Landungsversuch des Feindes vorbereitet, gleich wo oder wann kommen mag. Generalfeldmarschall Rommel besichtigt einen Stützpunkt nach dem anderen. General der Artillerie Jodl. Überfahrt auf einem Vorpostenboot.
Was it busy at night?
Always busy. Yeah. Always busy. Everyone was... Other people were doing shifts when we were there. And, I mean, we had a break of an hour in the middle of those shifts. But that was all we had. And, I mean, it was hell for leather. We were so pressurised when it was really just before D-Day.
I've heard that it got...
It was slave labour, absolutely. Yeah. It really was. But, I mean, we didn't object because we knew it mattered.
Did you get a feeling that something big was about?
Oh, we knew it was coming.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes. We were getting German messages, of course, from just across the channel because they were still thinking we were going to be there.
Yes, at Calais.
Yeah.
With this information on the 58 divisions making up the German order of battle, that's quite a tactical, physical representation. You could pin it on a map of the situation of the Germans. Was there information about the strategic plans and the intentions of the Germans?
This is the other thing that's coming out of particularly the Fisch traffic, the Lorenz traffic, because you've got these conversations between von Rundstedt and the German high command and the other link, Brehm, which connects Kesselring, who's commanding in Italy with the German high command. Kesselring and von Rundstedt and Jodl and Keitel in Berlin, they all discuss what their plans are. And reading those messages allows a good portion of German strategic thinking to emerge. One of the issues they have is that Rommel is appointed to be inspector of defences in France in the spring of 1944. And he has a different conception of what they should do from Hitler and von Rundstedt. So there's a kind of back and forth between them about Rommel's defensive plan versus Hitler and von Rundstedt's defensive plan. Von Rundstedt argues, quite reasonably in many ways, that the coast he's set to defend is so long that you can't be strong everywhere, and that the best thing to do is to keep particularly armoured units somewhere central, you know, sort of near Paris. And then once the Allies land and you know where they've landed, you can then throw a very heavy punch against them. And he sets up Panzergruppe West, which is this sort of concentrated formation of panzer divisions for exactly that purpose. Rommel comes to France with experience in Italy and North Africa, and he says the problem with that strategy is that if the Allies have air superiority, which they will, moving formations around from place to place is very, very difficult because they get bombed. So if your panzer division is 100 miles from the battlefield, getting it to the battlefield isn't a simple operation. So he says the troops need to be where they're going to fight before the invasion ever starts, and that basically the armoured units need to be distributed near the coast.
Obviously, they knew it was on the coast, but they just weren't able to pinpoint at which point on the coast.
Exactly. And they actually come up with a compromise solution where Rommel gets some panzer units, and the result is that both 21st Panzer and, to a certain extent, 12th SS Panzer are in the Normandy area. But also, von Rundstedt has retained some units in Panzergruppe West. But that conversation is happening in German signals traffic. And Bletchley can't follow it in extreme detail, but they certainly get a sense of what's going on. Also, von Rundstedt, in his assessments, gives predictions of what he thinks is going to happen. You can tell from his messages in the spring of 1944, it's fairly obvious, but he says things like, it's going to be this year. Then later he says, it's pretty clear to me that the Allied preparations are complete. We can expect this any day now. And so you're getting that sense of his thinking. The second layer to that, of course, is the Japanese. When General Oshima, the ambassador, is meeting Hitler, he has conversations with Hitler about what's going to happen. One of the most famous incidents of this is the 28th of May, 1944, so a week or 10 days before the invasion. Oshima goes to Berchtesgaden and has a long meeting with Hitler, he has tea with Hitler, and they discuss the potential invasion. And it's at that point that Hitler thinks there might be a landing in Normandy. That hasn't been completely, you know, ruled out by the Germans. But he says, if there is a landing in Normandy, don't worry about it because it'll be a feint, essentially, and that the main attack is still coming in Calais. He's believed for years that if there's going to be invasion, it's going to be in Calais. He never really changed his mind about that.
Top secret. From Japanese Ambassador Berlin to Minister for Foreign Affairs, Tokyo. Dated the 28th of May, 1944. On the 27th, I called on Foreign Minister Ribbentrop at Fuschel and lunched with him, having about 2 hours' conversation. And during the afternoon of the same day, I had about 2 hours' conversation with Hitler at the Berghof. The following is a resume of my conversation with Führer Hitler. Section 3. Speaking of the Second Front, Hitler said that he himself thought that sooner or later, operations for the invasion of Europe would be undertaken. He thought that about 80 divisions had already been assembled in England. I accordingly asked the Führer if he thought these British and American troops had completed their preparations for landing operations, and he replied in the affirmative. I then asked him in what form he thought the Second Front would materialise, and he told me that, at the moment, what he himself thought was most probable was that, after having carried out diversionary operations in Norway, Denmark, the southern part of the west coast of France, and the French Mediterranean coast, they would establish a bridgehead in Normandy or Brittany, and, after seeing how things went, would then embark upon the establishment of a real second front in the Channel.
The Allies have put a huge amount of effort into reinforcing the Germans' belief that the invasion would be in Calais. There's the deception operations, Operation Fortitude South, and the wider bodyguard operation, and all the double-cross spies, and that whole separate story is about reinforcing the Germans' conception that the invasion would be in Calais. But Bletchley is able to discover exactly what Hitler's thinking days before the invasion through that message from Ambassador Oshima.
Is it a really detailed response then? Does it outline why
Hitler thinks that? It's pages long again. He's going, well, we discussed this and we discussed this and Hitler said this and this and this. And so that close to the invasion, it's unlikely that Eisenhower had been able to completely change the plan. At that point, they're kind of committed. But it's certainly reassuring to know that what you hope is happening from the Germans' point of view is happening. Mm. You know, that they still have a misconception about what's going to happen. And this is the other function of intelligence. As well as providing absolutely concrete information, that you change your plans as a result of. It has that confidence-building function. It has that confirmatory function that, you know, you can feel comfortable that what you're doing is probably going to succeed.
So the invasion planners, they have some insight into Hitler and the high command's thinking. They're confident that perhaps they're looking the wrong way, and they know what they'd be facing if they invaded at that point, because they know the locations and the strengths and the order of battle of the German divisions in the West. Obviously, this helped a huge amount with the details of the planning, but can you give us a bit of insight into how it helped?
We've talked already about the political decision, the idea that if there's too many Germans there, you can't have an invasion. And that information is vital not only to the decision to launch the invasion, but also the scale of it. The original plan, as set out, provides only for 3 invasion beaches. When Montgomery looks at that plan as commander 21st Army Group, he's the man that's actually going to have to command that battle. And he looks at the strength of the German defences and decides that that's probably not enough, that the Allied effort isn't big enough to deal with the number of Germans they're going to face. And as a consequence of that, 2 additional beaches are added, and you end up with 5 invasion beaches instead of 3, and an additional airborne division as well. So 3 airborne divisions, 8 divisions in total. And that decision about the size of the operation is at least in part derived from knowing what the enemy are going to do, how many Germans there are. So it's not only whether or not to do it, it's on what scale to do it. And of course, if you decide that you need to launch a bigger invasion, that has all sorts of planning implications about how soon you can do it. And in the end, they have to put back the invasion from the beginning of May to the beginning of June, because they don't actually have enough landing craft to launch the operation when they were originally planning, but they want to scale it up.
That's really interesting as well, because it might be easy to think, well, with all this information, clearly the invasion was going to be a lot more easy than they thought. But actually, with all this information, they discovered that they'd require more strength than perhaps they'd planned already. And so it's not going to be a walk in the park. The fight still had to take place. And actually, the fight had to be shored up as well and reinforced in order to ensure success.
This is a really important point, that intelligence isn't always good news. Sometimes the information that you learn about your enemy is just how strong he is, not that he's particularly weak. And it's easy in hindsight to look at Normandy and think that D-Day was always going to succeed. Right up to the end of the campaign in August, there was tremendous concern that the Germans would just be too strong and that the Allies would lose the battle. And so every piece of information that comes into Bletchley isn't necessarily making the Allied planners happier. You know, the more you know about the Germans doesn't make the fight easier. Sometimes the more you know about the Germans makes the fight look more difficult. And that's an important point to get across, that intelligence won't win you the battle. You know, someone still has to fight. And all you can do is tell that soldier what he's up against. Mm-hmm. He's still got to do the job on the ground. And if what you tell him is the guy you're facing is really, really strong, you know, this is the contrast with the Allies versus the Germans, that the German hierarchy, the Nazi hierarchy, was resistant to bad news in that way. And a lot of their intelligence efforts are hindered by the fact that people don't want to report stuff that they think will upset Hitler because they'll get the sack. And you have to have an intelligence network that is capable of speaking truth to power in that way, because sometimes the bad news needs to be told. And that's something that succeeds on the Allied side and in many ways fails on the German side.
All contact with the shore has ended. No one may come aboard. No one may go ashore. In Navy jargon, the ship and all of us aboard here are sealed. We're sealed because we've been told the answers. The answers to the questions that the whole world has been asking for 2 years and more. Where and how and when. Troops swarmed up the rope ladders last night. Strong, healthy, formidable men, many of them going into battle for the first time. As you walk along the decks, men are reading, or sleeping, or talking in small clusters.
The intelligence partially led to the decision to increase the number of beaches, for example. Were there any other situations where intelligence changed the details of the invasion?
Well, there's one particular case which happens at the end of May, really late on, and which actually potentially saved quite a lot of lives, because the original conception of the US parachute landings, there's 2 divisions, there's 101st Airborne and 82nd Airborne. And the idea was that they would land at the base of the Cottontown Peninsula. This is the bit on the sort of the west, the left-hand side, as you look at the map of Normandy, there's a peninsula with Cherbourg at the top of it. The original idea was if you could drop the 2 parachute divisions across the base of the peninsula, you could completely cut off all the Germans up towards Cherbourg. And at a stroke, you'd have isolated all of those from the rest of France. However, in May, a series of messages come in talking about the 91st Luftlande Division, and this is a German airborne or semi-airborne unit, including paratroops, that is moved into the Cotentin Peninsula and it sets up exactly where the 82nd Airborne's drop zone was going to be. And what that means is if the plan had gone ahead as originally conceived, those paratroopers would be dropping literally onto the heads of very competent German units. I mean, the parachute units in particular are more or less elite troops. They're very good.
Western Front Committee, report dated 26th of May, 1944. German forces in the West. High grade and traffic analysis. Section 5, infantry. Bringing up of the 91st Air Landing Division into the Cherbourg Peninsula is being carried out. Its battle HQ is at Château Haut, north of Carentan. This formation was formerly in the Vannes area.
That information is passed to the American commander, General Bradley, and he and his team decide that they need to move the 82nd Airborne's landing zones. And actually, they come up with a more conservative plan where that airborne division lands closer to Utah Beach on the eastern side of the peninsula, and they don't attempt to completely cut the peninsula off. And so that's quite a large change to the plan with only 2 weeks to go before the attack's going to happen. But they're able to make it because that signals intelligence comes in and warns them that those Germans are there. When you look at the landings of the 82nd and 101st Airborne, it's just as well they did because the American parachute landings were not tremendously successful from the point of view of the drop zones. American paratroopers got scattered all over kind of northern France in the early hours of D-Day. So had they stuck to the original plan and things had still gone as wrong as they did on the day, it would have been very, very bad for American paratroopers. As it is, most of the 82nd drop on Saint-Mère-Église, which is now famous for the fighting that took place there. But the fact that they land there is a direct consequence of being able to change the plan days before the invasion happened.
Oh, we had the radio. Well, now the other thing was we had an American airborne division stationed just up the road from us in Quorn. Well, that was jolly nice for the girls, wasn't it? I mean, I got there late on, but they had all sorts of social events with the Americans, had a great time. And one of our girls was married to one of them. Well, now, an airborne division, and they obviously knew exactly what they were there for, what they were going to do. And we knew, and I've often wondered this, how did we know there was going to be an invasion of France? Well, of course, it had come from the Americans, hadn't it? They wouldn't have told us their orders. I mean, I wasn't friendly with any of them because I'd only just got there. But I'm sure that's where we got information from, that we knew something was about to happen. And I expect their leave was cancelled and one thing or another. They wouldn't have kept it all to themselves, I don't suppose. And then I remember I got up one morning, went outside the door, and all these gliders were going over. Dozens of gliders were going right across us, going due south. And then, of course, that's what we knew. That was D-Day. That was the invasion. And we never saw the Americans again. They'd gone. The whole unit just went.
Really?
Over to France, yes.
The first aircraft that is going to lead the very front in the early hours of tomorrow morning is turning onto the end of the tarmac to make its takeoff. A graceful machine. And its wingtip light shining red and green over the heads of the dark, small figures of people on the aerodrome watching it take off. Taking off from here loaded with parachutists, and taking with it perhaps the hopes and the fears and the prayers of millions of people in this country who sleep tonight not knowing that this mighty operation is taking place. There she goes now, the first aircraft leading the attack on Europe.
There was a huge amount of information being provided, it sounds like, to the planners preparing for the D-Day invasion. And Bletchley Park seems to be right at the centre of this. Is it true that we could say that Bletchley Park was fundamental to the planning of D-Day right from 2 years beforehand? Or do we have to be quite careful about the extent to which we talk about BP's contribution?
I think BP makes a very, very important contribution. I mean, as we've talked about, there are a number of intelligence agencies working there. You've got the SOE spies, you've got the air reconnaissance. But it enables the planners to get this complete picture. Without the signals intelligence component of that broader intelligence picture, that picture would have been very partial. And it's the ability to combine it with everything else that produces quite an unprecedented level of understanding of what they're facing. It's very, very rare that a battle is attempted with quite as much prior knowledge of your enemy as was the case on D-Day.
And is it true to say that almost every element of that prior knowledge had in some way had some connection to Bletchley Park?
I think you can trace a link. I mean, it becomes 6 degrees of separation after a while. But there are definitely threads, tendrils from Bletchley that extend into all the different aspects of the campaign. And we've just been talking about the land battle here. There's a whole separate strand because Bletchley at the same time are working on the Luftwaffe and German air defence. That's a two-stranded operation because they're not only preparing for D-Day, they're running the ongoing bombing campaign of Germany. And so there's lots of intelligence which has been gathered for both those purposes. So Bletchley's also doing that at the same time. And they're providing intelligence for the campaign in Italy. We talked about last time how successful the intelligence flow to Italy was. So they've got fingers in all these different pies, if you like, and they're contributing to all these battles at the same time. Hut 3, they're not just spending 18 months thinking about D-Day. They're spending 18 months thinking about D-Day while fighting the battle in Italy, while other bits of Bletchley are thinking about the war in the Pacific. So the fact that they managed to keep as many balls in the air as they do is very impressive.
So Bletchley Park's contribution, whilst we have to be careful not to over-egg it, was still kind of at the centre of pretty much everything that the Allies did on D-Day.
I think it's fair to say that signals intelligence touches almost all aspects of the campaign. What we have to remember, though, and this is something that we talk about in the film, in the exhibition, is, as I said before, intelligence doesn't win the campaign for you. The soldiers still have to fight. And one of the things I think we're both pleased about the film is the fact that it begins and ends with the troops because they are the ones at the sharp end. But I think you can fairly argue that Bletchley gave them the best chance on the beach at the end of the day.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.